Production. Recorded live.
Welcome to Voices of Peace Talk Radio. I am Adam Erickson.
And I'm Bob Kohler.
Bob, before we tell people about the show, I just want to say that I'm sorry for putting you through Tina Turner this morning. But, Bob, I could have done this. And that would have hurt.
That,
that would not be good.
I love Whitney.
You do?
Yeah,
you like that
Whitney.
Song? Did you see The Bodyguard?
No, I didn't see The Bodyguard.
No, well, one day maybe we'll see it.
But
how about February 14th? What are you doing?
I'm going to go see The Bodyguard.
Oh, okay. All right, let's see it together. All right, well, let's tell people what Voices of Peace is about. For too long, good people seeking an end to violence and war have believed that peace could be achieved through tighter security, threats of violence, or defeating our enemies.
But the world's faith in violence as a way to achieve peace is wavering. Today, we are poised on the brink of a paradigm shift as innovative peacemakers challenge the old approaches. Their work is demonstrating that to achieve a global and enduring peace, we must use peaceful means.
So at Voices of Peace, we bring you the opportunity to engage with creative thinkers and practical, field-tested activists from around the globe. Our hope is that we can learn from their experiences and offer our encouragement and support, so that together we can strengthen the chance for peace in our lifetime. So, Bob, as I mentioned, Valentine's Day is coming up. Did you get me anything?
Well, yes. I stopped at Walgreens on the way up here, and I got some toothpaste. I'd be happy to share it with you.
You are so sweet.
Oh, people say that all the time.
I've got nothing but love for you, Bob.
Yeah, I know what you're saying.
Well, you know, people are all about love this time of year, and love is a very tricky thing. So today we have two guests with us. Our first guest is the co-founder of the Raven Foundation, Suzanne Ross. Hi, Suzanne.
Hi, Adam.
How are you today?
I'm great.
You ready to talk about love?
Can't wait.
All right. Well, we're here to talk about your book, The Wicked Truth About Love, and I just want to point out to our listeners that we have three books for you today, The Wicked Truth About Love, three copies to give out. To be entered into a drawing to win a copy of The Wicked Truth About Love, go ahead and send an email to info@ravenfoundation.org during this hour, and winners will be notified a little later on. Our second guest today is the husband of the very famous Organized Like Jen. You can find Organized Like Jen on her website, which is
OrganizedJen.com.
OrganizedJen.com, and that voice was the husband of Jen Ross, Don Ross. Don, thank you for being with us today.
It's my pleasure.
We are going to talk about love. Now, Suzanne, in my 10 years of marriage, I've learned two important rules about love that every man should know, and I'm sure that Don can back me up on this. The first rule is that the wife is always right. And the second rule is that if there are any questions, you should always refer to rule number one. Yeah? Yeah. But, Suzanne, in your book, you have the audacity to say that love is a little deeper than that. So what I want to do is ask you, why did you write a book about love?
Thank you, Adam. I appreciate you bringing up a very funny line, which my husband used after we were married for 17 years. He said it took him 17 years to figure out I was always right.
It only took me 10.
I know. You're an advanced learner.
There you
clearly.
Go.
Clearly. And we've been married 33 years, I'm happy to say. So his technique worked. So I think everyone finds their own techniques to make their relationships work. But what I was noticing in my own life and in the lives of people around me was that love sometimes can be a difficult thing to find and a difficult thing to sustain in relationships. A lot of loving relationships start out loving and end up in conflict. Things kind of blow up and you're not sure what happened. And I began to realize that a lot of the problems around love had to do with misunderstandings about how humans relate to one another, not just in love relationships, but in general. Like, how do human relationships work in the first place?
Okay, so what is the misunderstanding of how human relationships work?
Well, it's very common in our culture to think of human beings as these very autonomous, discrete, self-starting individuals. You know, we have this sense of ourselves as, I use the image in the book of billiard ball.
Yeah, what's the metaphor of the billiard ball?
Well, that there's some true self deep down inside of you.
And you said that it has nothing to do with being bald, right?
Well, sorry, Bob. Yeah, it doesn't. But it has to do with having an outer shell, an outer core that we kind of show to others, and that is our surface for interacting with others, and we tend to bounce off of each other. But our inner self is where our true self resides. And that if we, you know, remember that expression, follow your bliss, from about 20 years ago? I'm going to date myself with a lot of my metaphors and analogies. But it was like, if you want happiness, just look deep inside. You'll find your true self there and then just act on it.
Okay.
Now, there's something that's very true about that. Yes, we do have a self that lives within us, but we weren't born with it. It didn't just spontaneously emerge. It developed and was brought into being through our interactions with one another.
Okay.
And so we may sometimes feel like, oh, you know, I really, really would like a cup of coffee, or I really would like a piece of chocolate cake. And we think that desire just is ours. It emerged spontaneously within us, where the truth is, it's in there now, but it got there from someone else. We learn what to desire from observing what other people desire.
Wow.
And that's what makes us human.
So what does, this is fascinating, what does this have to do with love?
Well, in the arena of love, we often think that our desires for other people are just spontaneously arising from within us. And we forget how we're influenced by the culture around us, by the world around us, to find certain types of people and certain individuals or groups of people desirable.
Yeah.
And others to be not so.
I have a great example.
Yeah.
Can I bring it up?
Absolutely.
Okay, so last month, there was the NCAA football championship game.
Right.
And it was such a boring game that the announcers were trying to figure out something to talk about. So what do? You talk about the star quarterback's girlfriend, who happens to be Miss Alabama. And the announcers say, oh, look at her, she's so hot. So at that moment, this is an example, I think, of what you're talking about, of culture directing our attention to what is desirable. So since Brent Musburger says, look at her, she's so hot, we all look at her and say, oh, yeah, she is hot.
Well,
in other words, love is a spectacle.
Yeah.
Well, in a lot of ways. I mean, Brent didn't, you know, spontaneously decide that Miss Alabama was desirable. That's a cultural standard of beauty that he's responding to.
She happens to be Miss Alabama, so he's clearly getting this standard of beauty.
She's officially beautiful. She's been
in our
certified.
Culture.
Right, right.
And also the girlfriend of the star quarterback, which I think is something that they mentioned. And another one of those dynamics, that the quarterback is that position of honor.
Mm-hmm.
So whoever the quarterback associates with, well, I want to associate with them too.
So she's been certified twice as desirable.
Right. Yeah. So tell us how this worked in your life as you were growing up and having these influences on you personally.
Right. I actually succumbed to the football player as desirable.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's
Broadway Joe, my friend. He was my idol. And then when I went away to college, I thought, if I could just date a football player, I will have arrived, right? And lucky for me that they were really nice guys, but they weren't Joe Namath, you know. They weren't what I thought they were going to be, perfection in a football uniform. I don't know. It was very strange. And so I slowly had to work my way out of accepting what the culture had given me. I mean, the other cultural thing that girls get is the fairy tale ending, you know, looking for the prince that's going to come in and save you. And I had this sense that what guys wanted was a girl who just agreed with them, just affirmed them all the time. I thought that's what you were supposed to do. Princesses are usually, like, pretty quiet, and they don't make demands. They just sort of show up on the arm of the prince, and, you know. And I had one of these football player guys break up with me, and when he broke up with me, he said, I can't believe you don't have a thought of your own. Why don't you ever say something that's your own?
Ouch.
Does
that fall into the category of life experience?
Yes, it does, but it was really important for me to begin to sort through these things that I'd learned from the culture. And, you know, a lot of things you learn from outside yourself are really good and healthy and wonderful things. But you have to learn to sort through the ones that are useful and the ones that aren't. And then become conscious of how you're living into things that maybe aren't in your own best interest.
So we are always influenced by others. We're always influenced by our culture. Who were some of the people, I guess, in your life that helped you to discern what is a positive view of love and what is maybe a false view of love or a negative view?
Yeah. Well, I mean, like the people that broke up with me.
Yeah.
That was always very healthy. And my own husband, Keith and I have learned together what a loving relationship is. And the key thing that Keith taught me about love is that love doesn't quit. You know, love doesn't walk out when things get tough. And in the early years of our marriage, I have to say, I had a lot of depression. And I had a lot of becoming to do. I still wasn't a person. I didn't know who I was. And I went through some really dark, dark times. And I remember Keith asking me, is it always going to be like this? Because I was not a happy person to be around. And he wanted to know, is it always going to be like this? And I said, I don't know. But are you going to leave me?
Wow.
And he said, oh, no. I just wanted to know.
Wow.
And I, you know, I can cry thinking about it right now because it wasn't like he was looking for an out. He was just looking for what is it? What is it that I'm in for?
Wow. What a gift. I mean, he had to have learned what that kind of faithfulness of love is from someone else. If we're always influenced by what surrounds us, he must have been influenced by his parents or by someone in his life. And what a gift to give to your son to see that kind of faithfulness and devotion.
Well, it's interesting because I don't remember hearing that story, but I do remember my mother teaching me the idea that love is a choice, which is not what you hear. You hear, well, love is something you fall into. That's what you see in the movies. It just happens, and then you're in love, and it's great. And then you just hope.
That is the expression.
You just hope that you stay in love, you know, because it would suck if you weren't anymore. But really, it's a choice you have to make every morning and every moment.
You fall in love until you hit bottom.
Yeah.
But maybe that is an accurate metaphor. You hit bottom, and then you go, okay, do I want to really be in love
exactly.
or not?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Going back to the whole idea of billiard balls, which I think is just a fascinating metaphor, it reminds me of Abraham Maslow and the whole I-it versus I-thou relationship with other people. And a billiard ball has an I-it relationship.
Yes, right.
What is the other thing? What is the I-thou relationship, and what does that have to do with love? I mean, is it only the one other person in your life, your mate, or does love have something that connects you to the whole human race?
Oh.
Can I throw in a quote here?
Yes.
Because that I-thou thing, Maslow's hierarchy of needs, the very top of that is self-actualization.
Right.
So I have this quote from Viktor Frankl, who's an Austrian, or was an Austrian neuroscientist, psychiatrist, and Holocaust survivor.
Right.
And he has this quote about self-actualization, which I think is just fantastic. It's from his book, Man's Search for Meaning, which I read back in high school, and this just has stuck with me ever since. So it goes, being human always points and is directed to something or someone other than oneself, be it meaning to fulfill or another human being to encounter. The more one forgets himself by giving himself to a cause to serve or another person to love, the more he is and the more he actualizes himself. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, the more human he is and the more he actualizes himself. Mm-hmm. What is called self-actualization is not an attainable aim at all, for the simple reason that the more one would strive for it, the more he would miss it. In other words, self-actualization is possible only as a side effect of self-transcendence.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, that's deep.
Yeah.
That's very deep. And that's my son, by the way, in case that didn't come across. He is the husband of Organized Gem, but he's also the son of Suzanne.
I was your son first, yeah.
Yes, exactly. And I'm glad you brought that in at this point, Don, because it is a perfect response to Bob's question, and just to sort of expand on it, the thing about human beings that makes us wonderful creatures is that we have an openness to one another. We have what, psychologists try to define and neuroscientists try to measure our brain mirror neurons and all of that. But there's something about being human at its most essential thing, which is an openness to being influenced by others.
In the beginning of the book, you talk about the theory that's kind of behind this. It's called mimetic theory.
Right.
And I want you to say a little bit more about the openness that mimetic theory points to.
Yeah, okay, great, because that is, mimetic theory is sort of behind all the work we do at the Raven Foundation and behind our understanding of what is an authentic peace look like and how would you find peace.
Mm.
And what mimetic theory teaches is that we have a psychological draw towards the other. We do not exist in isolation. There is actually no such thing as an individual.
Mm.
The term that was coined to express how we exist in connection to one another is this term interdividual.
Wow.
We exist, well, you know, people know this, there are these famous reports of babies left in orphanages unattended.
Right.
And they call, I think, this failure to thrive or something. But they were fed, their diapers were changed, but they had no other human interaction, and they died.
Right.
So what I was talking about earlier about how the self is brought into being, we are born with an incredible capacity to become. And the becoming happens in relationships.
You call it the talent for becoming.
Yep.
In the book.
That's right.
And the becoming happens in connection with the person that is nurturing you as a baby.
Absolutely.
I have such a vivid memory of holding my now 7-year-old great nephew, Joey, and when he was like 2 or 3 days old. And it was just so powerful. Every touch I felt kind of his whole body radiated. I was nurturing him even as though I were giving him breast milk, just from the touch. Everything, he was growing and becoming in those moments as I held him. It was unbelievable.
Yeah.
It was so powerful.
Well, thank God you were there to hold him, because not every baby, as Suzanne pointed out earlier, is nurtured.
It reminds me, that reminds me, a baby's born in prison.
Right.
Mm.
Under horrible circumstances for the mother giving birth, then the baby's taken away and put in a baby locker or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, this is the prison system's gift to humanity, an unloved baby. I mean, it's horrible to think about.
It's tragic. It's tragic.
No, it really is.
What? So you have this talent for becoming, and we're formed by our environment. Don earlier said that love is a choice.
Mm-hmm.
If we are always formed by what is other, there's a certain sense in which one could say that we're enslaved to our culture.
Right.
Where does choice come into this? Mm. Where does free will come into this issue of love?
Right. No, that's an excellent question, and this idea of Frankl's of self-actualization ties into that. You know, this becoming goes on when you're an infant naturally, unconsciously. You don't have to intend to become. It happens to you, right? But as you grow and develop and do become something, someone, you then become capable of choosing and selecting among the many influences that are around you. And we do connect ourselves with people that we want to influence us. And we can choose that. So, you know, a lot of times you'll see, it's a very good example is cliques in high schools, you know. People are looking for a source of identity somewhere, so they connect with a clique. Now, a lot of times the clique will decide whether you're in or out. So a lot of this choice is sometimes limited. But if you can say, well, no, I'm belonging to a group of people that's really destructive for me. If you can bring that into consciousness, and say, maybe I should choose to be connected with a different group of people, even if it means I'm going to be alone for a while until I find someone else to be with, then what you're doing is bringing into consciousness the reality that you cannot be someone without a group. You have to be connected somewhere, even if it's to, I got really connected when I was in high school, to novelists. Mm-hmm. Russian novelists, you know, they became a little source of identity for me. So, you know, who you attach to doesn't have to be alive or really physically present. You could belong to, any kind of a belief system or something that you connect to. But the point of this is to say, unless you acknowledge the fact that you need an other, some other to be connected to in order to be the person you want to be, you'll never get to the point of being conscious that there's a choice involved.
Mm.
Right?
Yeah.
So there is a choice involved, not when you're an infant, of course, and sometimes life circumstances force those choices upon you. But if you're lucky, you get to a place in your life where you can make those choices.
Nice. Maura has questions from the chat room, but before we do that, I want to remind callers that if you have a question for Suzanne or Don, please press *8 on your phone and we'll bring you into the call. Maura, we have a chat room question.
We actually have a couple of them, and two of them came from Jody, and I think they fit right in here quite nicely, and I'm going to go with her second question first. Do you feel that for women, a great fault is that we feel our love is based on expectations from what we think men should be or from religious dogma?
Well, absolutely. We tend to, I think men have the same problem, though. There's these idealized, concepts floating around of what is the right person. What do they look like? What do they think? What do they feel? How do they act? What kind of job do they have? You know, and we tend to limit our field of vision as we're looking around for someone to connect with. We allow those ideals to limit our field that we'll choose from.
It's when you're in high school, it's the star quarterback. Everybody wants to be like the star quarterback. As you grow up, you want to be the CEO, and then you know that you've made it.
Yeah.
There are all of these expectations to be successful, as culture tells us successful is, and then you know that you are lovable.
Well, and sadly for women, the body ideal, the body type ideal that women think they must have in order to be desirable, or the body type that they think their man must have in order to be desirable is very limiting.
Well, yeah. I mean, you see during the Super Bowl last Sunday, there was this Calvin Klein commercial that just put my body to shame.
Oh, my God.
And I was like, if I get Calvin Klein underwear, will I look like that?
Just avert your eyes,
yeah, there
Adam.
You go.
Just avert
you have
your
to get
eyes.
The right size.
Yes, really.
So, but Jody asked another question, which kind of points back to a little bit of the billiard ball,
yeah,
or the malleability, and that do you find that a woman's typical romantic type can change over the years, or can even be a match between two or more types? You know, your quiz gives us six types.
Ah, yes. Right. Well, yes, that's very interesting. To talk just briefly about the quiz, what I tried to do was identify some of the pitfalls you can fall into because we are so open to one another and learning what to desire from one another. How can that cause problems in love relationships? And so that's why I call them tangles. And Jody's pointing to something very important about the tangles, is that they are not fixed traits. A tangle is a pattern that you can easily fall into and feel as if you're trapped in it. But the idea behind what I was trying to do was to point out these are just patterns of behavior. You can shift them. They will shift over time. You actually might be a combination of different aspects of different of these tangles. So yes, they will, hopefully you do shift and grow over time. If you are a static billiard ball type person who resists changing, who thinks that they need to preserve who they are at this moment at any cost, you will have a difficult time finding healthy relationships.
That reminds me of a conversation that we had just a little bit ago, that in these love relationships, it's the Viktor Frankl quote of self-actualization, there is something that transcends us as individuals. It always transcends us. And I think that in a love relationship, the thing that transcends each person is the relationship.
Yes.
Right? So there's you, there's me, and there's the third entity, which is the relationship.
The interdividual rapport.
Yeah, exactly. This is like the individual, interdividual other between us. And how we nurture that third entity, the relationship itself, I think is important for developing our love.
Yeah.
Yeah. Looks like we have a caller.
We actually have a couple more questions.
Okay, from the chat room.
So we have Vanessa has a couple questions, and her first question is: do you think most women think love is harder because they can't choose between like and love?
That they can't choose between like and love. You mean like as in a friendship?
Is a kind of a lesser form of love,
yeah.
I think.
There's like,
I like
and
you, but I don't
like.
I like you, but I don't love you.
Oh.
So you're positive on my scale, but you're not like over into the love.
But where are the fireworks?
Yeah,
like
the fireworks.
It's kind of like I like Diet Coke, but I love Coke, but I know that Diet Coke is better for me. So I got to go with what I like, maybe
by
not
Coke,
what I
you
love.
Coca Cola, not the other kind.
No, I meant the other kind.
Oh, okay, gotcha.
Oh my gosh.
No, what is this like and this love issue about, do you think?
Is love supposed to be good for me but not too exciting? Like, you know, if it's really, really exciting, does that mean there's something missing or something wrong?
So in the beginning of a relationship, you are on the top of the roller coaster,
mm-hmm.
or you're going up on the top of the roller coaster, and this is going to be exciting, this is awesome, this is how we know what love is, our emotions,
mm-hmm.
our feelings.
Mm-hmm.
And then what ends up happening is you get into this relationship after about 3 or 4 months, it's not as exciting as it used to be.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. Well, one of the tangles that we developed here, and I have to thank Adam and Maura, helped me develop these tangles because it was hard to pull the threads apart, the complexity that is love, and identify these different facets of it. But the superhero tangle is about someone who likes, who has really learned something. What I think is very true about love, which is that the things that we treasure the most are the things we protect as our own. We don't necessarily want, like if you really like chocolate cake and someone has their fork hovering over your piece of cake, you kind of say, hey, that's mine.
Right.
Get your own.
Yeah.
And that's very true. It's a symptom of all kinds of desire. When you really want and love something, you tend to be protective about it. Mm. And so superheroes have picked up on that, but then they've like distorted it and think that anything that someone's that's hard to get must be really desirable.
Mm.
It must be the thing I want because it's hard to get. And so they will chase after someone because that person says, well, you know what, we're not right for each other. I'm really not interested in a relationship with you. This isn't going to work. You live in Frisco. I live in New York. And the more obstacles there are, the more the superhero tangle thinks, well, then that must be true love.
Yeah.
That must be love because it's hard to get. And so we tend to get very confused.
An example of this Kevin Costner in The Bodyguard?
Oh, yeah. One of my favorite romantic movies.
Yeah.
Yes, I was so glad you played the theme song.
What is that about again?
Right.
Seen the movie?
You know, he's a bodyguard, and for him, you know, everything's hard. Everything's a risking your life.
But in particular, as a bodyguard, you're not supposed to fall in love with the person that you're guarding. That's not your emotions aren't supposed to get in the way.
Houston
is that forbidden fruit, and of course they fall in love.
Absolutely.
And with all forbidden fruit, the no makes you desire it even more.
Yeah.
And if that's what we think love is, you know, this question from Vanessa about like and love, I'm still trying to wrap my mind around because love can be mistakenly identified with the roller coaster excitement.
I've got maybe a different take on trying to answer that.
Yeah.
I've got one more Viktor Frankl quote
from
the same book, Man's Search for Meaning. I'll stop after this one. But this is about love specifically. He says, love is the only way to grasp another human being in the innermost core of his personality. No one can become fully aware of the essence of another human being unless he loves him. By his love, he is enabled to see the essential traits and features in the beloved person, and even more, he sees that which is potential in him, which is not yet actualized, but yet ought to be actualized.
Yeah.
Furthermore, by his love, the loving person enables the beloved person to actualize these potentialities. By making him aware of what he can be and of what he should become, he makes these potentialities come true. So I love that definition of love. And, you know, that's something that if you just like something, it's not, you think that love means that now you've seen even more things that you like about it.
Mm.
But in fact, what love means is that you've seen the deeper truth of the thing, the reality of its imperfections, and you've chosen to stick around. You've chosen to still care enough about this person to try to help them become what they have the potential to become. So to me, that's what love is. And it's, you know, we get so confused by the romantic love, the excitement of, and the novelty of a new relationship. And it really can't, I don't think it can become that kind of deep and meaningful love until you've gone through that stage, that honeymoon period. It always happens, and then you start seeing the, you know, reality for what it is.
The things you don't like about the person.
And to what Adam was saying about the third thing being the relationship between the two people, this is where it gets a little tricky. Because, you know, for example, I would say one of the things I love the most about my wife is how much she loves me.
Mm-hmm.
But my love for her isn't conditional on that.
Right.
And so it's a weird thing of how do you get into that spot?
Yes. Yep.
It's almost like success creates failure in a sense that, she does love me, and I love that, but I love her. Wait, but do I love her more than I love the fact that she loves me?
Yeah.
It does get confusing.
Yeah.
It gets all twisted.
Right, but I think that's a good way to think about it, Don, because, excuse me, you know you're lovable because someone gazed lovingly at you when you were a baby. It was me.
Thanks, Bob.
but that's how we learn that we're lovable, from the gaze of someone else. And what you have committed to with Jen is you two have decided that it's each other's gaze that's the most important gaze.
Yeah.
And you will... it's like with Keith, a lot of times I will say to him, honey, I'm having a hard time today. Could you just sit down and look at me?
Wow.
And I just need him to eyeball to eyeball look at me. Yeah. And it helps me buck up my sense of self because it's a loving gaze. I trust it. It's there through thick and thin. Mm-hmm. It's somewhere I can anchor myself.
Yeah.
Now, if he didn't love me that way, I couldn't trust him enough to love him back, to be at that vulnerable to him. So you are looking for that sweet spot of saying, you know, of finding how you're mutually sustaining one another.
Right.
You know, it's one of the other tangles. Just to look at the tangles for a minute, the sidekick tends to get caught up. They know very well that that's what love is, that love means giving yourself fully to another person. But they forget that it has that mutuality, and they'll give and give and give, even to people who are just taking.
So this is
taking.
The martyr
complex. And they're loving, giving, generous people, but they don't get the reciprocality of it, right? And so they get trapped in these very destructive relationships. And, one line in the book I use is that some people, unfortunately, are best loved from a distance. Mm-hmm. And there's some people that we cannot be in relationships with, no matter, you know, they're not ready or we're not ready, whatever. It's like there's no blame game here. It's just we need to separate. Yeah. We need to walk away.
It looks like we have another chat room question. Maura?
Yes, we actually have two. Another one from Vanessa, and she said, how is love harder than being single?
I don't know, Vanessa. Tell me. How is love harder than being single?
Well, if I can try. Suppose that when you are in a loving... in a relationship of love, you have to give yourself over to something that's bigger than you. You have that attachment. This is an attachment that is a good thing, but you may not be ready for it yet because
it
love,
takes a lot of effort.
Exactly. Love is hard work.
Yeah.
Relationships are hard work. Mm-hmm. And if you want to be single, there are some people that I have met in my life who I think should stay single. Because they aren't ready to give
But that
themselves.
Doesn't mean they should stay billiard ball.
Right. They're not billiard balls. They're always formed by something other, but they're not ready to give themselves over to a love relationship that's bigger than themselves. And so in that sense, staying single, you're not attached to an other.
Yeah.
In that intense way, I guess.
Right. Well, I think that probably the word single is maybe an inaccurate word in that no one
right.
is ever single.
Exactly.
But it implies something, you know.
There's a certain amount of...
It implies billiard balls.
There's a certain amount of of freedom, I think, in being single.
It's freedom you don't appreciate. Speaking as a single person...
Yeah, yeah.
I a single person that lost his wife some years ago... So I romanticize the marriage part of my life in ways where I forget the daily grind of, you know, the daily boredom of, you know, of laundry and blah, 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 and all of the the mundaneness, because, oh, I want that presence, the kind that you were talking about. I want that loving gaze when, you know, when I feel lonely and that sort of thing. And I don't appreciate, you know, truly this, you know, but suddenly if I find myself remarried, I know I will romanticize the singleness of my life
right.
now and the freedom to just do what I please.
Right.
And so you never get it. You never get it all at once. You get the,
mm-hmm.
you know, you get some of it, and then you miss, lose the other thing. And
look like we have. Oh, Don, go ahead.
Well, just a quick take on that. I mean, sort of another way of putting what Frankl was saying about the, you know, the paradox of self. Paradox of self-actualization only coming through self-transcendence, there's another way of putting that, which is the paradox of happiness, which is that long-term sustainable happiness doesn't come from pursuing happiness directly. It tends to come as the side effect of other things, like finding meaning and purpose and passion and someone to love. But that's, you know, that's a sort of delayed gratification type of deal.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
you know, I think there's certainly there's the freedom of being single. And, you know, I also, I would say that it but that comes with maybe the emptiness of not having that kind of connection. That doesn't mean you have to find someone to marry or have a traditional romantic relationship, but it means you have to have a connection that's about something that's more important
yes.
than, you know, what you're going to watch on Netflix this
right.
evening, even though I watch Netflix every evening and I love it.
Wait,
it
more
doesn't
important than
bring
Netflix?
Me
don't
talk my relationship. Happiness.
Yeah.
It could be just loving your friends, or it
yeah.
could be loving the cause of peace.
Well,
yes.
well
that
gets
there.
At a big thing that to kind of wrench this conversation open a little bit. You know, and maybe the word love is inadequate for everything we try to put on that word,
mm-hmm.
but what is the relationship between loving another person and loving, let us say, God or peace
sure.
or some big thing?
Mm-hmm.
This question popped into my head as we were talking. I thought of a quote that somebody gave me once when I was flying back from overseas, and my seatmate said, "Well, you know, you're as close to God as you are to the person you like the least," which has been a quote I've been
yeah.
struggling with, you know, in serious, you know, entanglement ever since then. But what does it mean to love God, if that's the word we want to use, or to love the universe? What does that mean? And is there desire connected to loving God?
Oh, I love this conversation because when we were talking about being single, I thought there are really good, healthy, productive lives that are lived as in singleness because they're committed to something like the religious life. People take vows of celibacy because they're committed to something that's bigger, to serving something
right.
that they believe in, and that it's love, to love God with all your heart, mind, and soul, and strength, is a real reality. It's a real thing that happens. And I think the biggest difference between loving and committing yourself in a single-minded way to something like God or to a cause is that you are very much less likely to come into conflict with God than you are with your spouse. And that's a truth about desire, that the more distance you have from the object of your love, or what we call the model for our desires. So if you love God, that means you desire according to God's desires. And that's prayer. Your prayer life is, make me desire what you desire, God. Put your desires in me, Paul says. You know, it is not I anymore that lives, but Christ who lives in me. So what we're trying to do is bring our desires in alignment with God's. When you desire the same thing as another human being, though, you can come into conflict with them over it. And we looked at this in the very, very first tangle, the best friend forever tangle. being in a friendship with someone means you're sharing desires with them. You're learning and sharing what to love and like and eat and what movies to watch on Netflix together, what games to play. This is like, it's, you know, a cauldron of shared desires. But if your friend brings home, brings a date to a party, and you continue to share desires with him and think that that date's for you too, you're in big trouble. You can, because the closer then you are in to the other physically, in time, in social fields or whatever, the more possibilities there are for you to desire an object that can't be shared.
So giving yourself over to something transcendent in a love relationship, the relationship,
yes,
always works with that relationship, but also with friendships.
Without a doubt.
So in this instance, you have your desire for something that can't be shared, a love interest. What is bigger in our friendship?
Yeah.
What is the best thing to do for our friendship,
exactly,
the, that relationship?
Exactly.
To prune away the desire for the shared love interest for the sake of our friendship.
Absolutely.
And that pruning is painful.
It's painful.
It is hard, painful work. But what is more important, the friendship?
Right. And to remember that your desire for this love interest didn't arise spontaneously within you.
Right.
You learned it from your friend.
The other thought when... to Bob's God question is, and at hearing you talk about it, Suzanne, this is one of those instances where it matters what we say about God.
Oh, yeah.
So if we are going to follow in the ways of God, it matters what we say God is. And the Judeo-Christian tradition says God is love. What does that mean? It means, to Bob's quote earlier that he got from the airplane ride, God loves God's enemies.
Mm-hmm.
Love your enemies. This way you will be sons and daughters of God, children of God.
And
so if you want to be close to God, you have to love the way that God loves.
And this is how we have our conflict with God.
Right.
Because if you think of the person you like the least and what a jerk that person is, and you go, I have to fall in love with this guy in order to reach God. No.
Well, and
but here, love is not an emotion. Love is an action,
a commitment,
a choice,
yeah,
a commitment. Is Donna saying?
Well, and the first story of the Bible is about rivalry with God.
Oh my goodness! Yeah.
Right, Adam and Eve. The whole story of the serpent tempting Eve by saying, "You know why you're not supposed to eat that fruit? Because God doesn't want you to have God's powers."
Right.
And he's like, "Oh yeah."
Yeah. Yeah.
And so it's the warning against that trap of when you share desire and then how easily can slip into rivalry, even with the one whose love for you is unrivaled, eternal, unconditional, you can still slip into rivalry.
Well, we always get in that story the way that Adam accuses Eve and Eve accuses the serpent, but Adam says, the woman whom you, God, made, pointing the finger at God, right? Even
exactly.
Accusing God
absolutely.
Right? The other thing that fascinates me about that story is that it doesn't say how Adam and Eve survived this experience of accusations against one another. You have to, people often say, oh, we fell apart, we tore apart, things just didn't work out. But how do you develop in these very painful moments acts of forgiveness?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is painful moment of betrayal that Adam and Eve experienced. How do you move beyond that?
They were exiled into reality.
Yeah.
they had to do something.
Yeah. Looks like we have a chat room question.
Oh, we have a very lively chat room. And we have another question that I thought when you were talking about BFFs, is that what about being at the opposite end? So Vanessa asks, is it possible to really love two different people at the same time? And then goes on to say, and what about someone saying they love you, but they're not in love with you? So
yeah,
interesting. Yeah.
Jeez, Vanessa. Can you love two people at one time? I can only speak from personal experience and say I don't know how I would manage it.
Well,
I mean, I love my...
Yeah,
what do you mean by love?
Using,
I'm
course.
Assuming it's because we're talking about romantic love. But I love everybody in this room. I love my other child. And
I love my mother.
I love... Yeah. But to you know, to give Vanessa's question, I think the appropriate... I think what she's talking about is the field of romantic love.
Yeah,
it's a,
right.
Can you... You know, love two people at the same time, and I would say that'd be very hard.
I think in getting back to the idea of love as kind of this collision with reality, when you try to love two people romantically at the same time, you multiply, it becomes an exponential reality. Mm-hmm. You are stuck with so much reality that humans aren't built to be able to handle that much reality.
Well,
I think that's what happens.
Yeah, you could certainly be attracted sexually to more than one person at one time.
Right, yeah, and that might be it, but you also have the attraction sexually to someone where you could have a commitment to friendship, too. You can fall in love with your friends. I mean, these emotions come and go throughout your life, and I think the question, like, I can see how people would fall in love with someone after getting married, someone else, but what is, again, it's about the relationship, and you are always going to have, culture is always telling us what is desirable,
mm-hmm.
what is lovable, what is maybe not lovable. You're always going to have this roller coaster of emotions, but what is the relationship that you are going to consciously give your life toward?
Exactly.
I think that is the question of
right.
of love.
And so it kind of brings up the question of the difference between love or in-loveness and
right.
seduction.
Right.
You know, and you can be deeply committed to a relationship and be seduced by somebody that's out there that's maybe the perfect man or woman.
Right.
And, oh, you know, that's a terrible dilemma,
right.
but it's part of the love equation
yeah.
to, when that comes up to deal with it in some sensible way. That
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What was the other half of Vanessa's question?
Well, part of it was
I actually think I made a mistake, so that I'm trying to – so that was actually Jody asking that question.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Thanks for the question, Jody.
Okay, Jody.
Yeah.
But what about someone saying they love you, but they aren't in love with you?
So I think that's actually where it's the sexual attraction is absent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And or in some way, when I love you, but I'm not in love with you, I'm saying that what I get from you isn't that the kind of love that I feel like I need in my committed relationship.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't mean that I don't, you know, I support you. That thing where I can help you actualize your potential, I can still do that.
Yeah.
But, you know, and whether this is innate human nature or a fundamental law of the universe or just a product of our culture, the way the institution of marriage and monogamy and committed relationships work is there's that commitment between the two individuals that my supporting you is going to be my life's priority.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's something that, like Bob was saying, it becomes exponentially more complicated when you're trying to balance that with a complex network of people.
Right.
I don't think that's really workable.
Well, I'm glad you brought up the a public commitment ceremony, because that the whole community is then recruited to support your endeavor.
Right.
And I think that's important to remember, that a marriage is a couple that's existing within networks and within
right.
a community. And a supportive community can really help you struggle through these difficult problems that sometimes you're confronted with.
Good.
Right?
It looks like we have time for one more chat room question.
Oh,
yes,
sure.
And so we have a question from Laura. And the first thing that she said was the gaze analogy is wonderful, and that the gaze is the one steady in the journey of a long-term relationship. But then she asked, how much weight does watching your parents' relationship have on an adult child?
Mm.
So it's great to have a parent and a child here to discuss that.
Go ahead, Don.
A lot. It's absolutely massive. I mean, I truly believe that my biggest advantage in life is having been raised in a household where my parents loved each other and they showed me that unconditional love.
Yeah.
It's just, it allows me to exist in the world from, it allows me to be vulnerable and not feel vulnerable. Mm-hmm. Allows me to have this feeling that I've already got what I need. I already am myself. I don't, you know, not that I don't love to get validation and praise, but I can have a failure at work. I can have a relationship go wrong. And I don't feel like my entire sense of self is threatened because of the way I was raised and the kinds of relationships I was able to witness and be a part of at a very young formative age.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So love is right there at the foundation of this self that we have built.
That is a powerful thing. We have about 5 minutes left. I just want to remind our listeners, if you want to be entered into a drawing to win a copy of The Wicked Truth About Love, please send an email to info@ravenfoundation.org in the next few minutes. And we'll notify our winners this afternoon. Suzanne, before we end, I want to ask you about some of the tangles of desires that are in your book. What are some of the other tangles? We've talked about the best friend forever,
and the superhero,
and the superhero, the
and the sidekick.
Is there any other one that you want to?
What's this custodian guy?
What's the custodian about?
Well, we have to thank Adam for coming up with the name for that tangle because it was very hard to figure out. The custodian represents what we were trying to describe as a healthy relationship. A healthy approach to a love relationship. And so we chose custodian because, but what Don was just saying, a lot of times our ego needs are in the way of actually seeing the other person for who they are. We're often looking at what they can do for us rather than what they need from us. And so the custodian is kind of the opposite of the rock star or the celebrity chef thing. So we're always trying to draw attention to themselves. I think it's very telling that someone who is capable of love, real, sincere, authentic love, is not generally a showy person. It's not the first person when you walk into a party who your eyes will be drawn to, because they don't need everybody to look at them and boost their egos. They're just quiet and they're there. And so to begin to be able to recognize people who are capable of giving you the love you need in a healthy way, you need to be able to see them.
Mm-hmm.
And they're hard to see sometimes.
Well, that brings us to about the end of our hour. Suzanne and Don, thank you for being with us today.
Our pleasure.
Fascinating conversation about love. Bob, just a few last-minute reflections.
I think we pretty much summed up everything that love is in this last hour, so it's hard to add anything further. But I did have one question, maybe for another show. Why is love so scary?
Yeah, why do you think?
No, I was asking you.
Yeah, I think it gets back to Don's earlier point about vulnerability.
Yeah.
You have to be vulnerable to receive it.
You're right.
Right, and there's so much in life that says, no, don't be vulnerable. You have to fortify your vulnerability and never be vulnerable. And I guess that becomes the billiard ball
It's a dangerous double bind. Don't be vulnerable because you always are vulnerable.
And recognizing it is actually the path to accessing your true power.
Yeah.
That's a very good point.
There you go.
Empowerment.
Yeah.
Empowerment. You can't have empowerment without love.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's going to be fake.
I think one of the things that's so powerful about Suzanne's book is exactly that billiard ball myth mentality. Just is everywhere.
I can't get these billiard balls out of my head. They're colliding right now.
I just think that is one of the key elements to understanding the wicked truth about love. And realizing that we are interdividuals always formed by the culture around us. What do you think love has to do with
Let me answer that by throwing out a word.
Okay.
One word, Ubuntu, U-B-U-N-T-U, a South African tribal word. The meaning is, I am because you are.
Mm.
And I think that's what love is.
I love it.
That's beautiful.
Excellent. And a great way to end our show. That brings us to the end of our hour. Bob and I would like to thank our guests, Suzanne Ross and Don Ross, for being with us today.
Thank you very much.
And a big thank you to all of you for tuning in to Voices of Peace. Once again, Suzanne's book is called The Wicked Truth About Love. You can find it on her website, thewickedtruthaboutlove.com. And you can also find it on amazon.com. You can help us share the word about this program by liking the Raven Foundation Facebook page. Our next scheduled episode is on February 21st at 11 a.m. Central with the award-winning theater director Heidi Stillman. We will discuss her current play, Bengal Tiger at the Baghdad Zoo, which runs through March 17th at Chicago's Looking Glass Theater. During the Broadway run, the tiger was played by Robin Williams, who summed up the play by saying that it is about a tiger that haunts the streets of present-day Baghdad, seeking the meaning of life. As he witnesses the puzzling absurdities of war, the tiger encounters Americans and Iraqis who are searching for friendship, redemption, and a toilet seat made of gold. So we hope that you can join us on February 21st as we interview Heidi Stillman about friendship, the consequences of war, tigers, and apparently the search for a golden toilet seat.
My life would be so much better if I had one of those.
I know it. Golden toilet seat.
Yeah.
In the meantime, please stay in touch with us. You can follow Bob at commonwonders.com, Suzanne and myself at ravenfoundation.org. Until then, friends, peace needs a voice. Let it be yours.
Phew.